From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Philippe Gelly, Washington correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. A dispute over funding for a wall at the U.S. southern border has led to a lack of funding legislation and a shutdown of the U.S. government. U.S. markets went on a roller coaster ride, recording record highs and lows as investors balanced solid economic indicators against interest rate hikes and political uncertainty. U.S. President Donald Trump's announcement that the U.S. will immediately pull troops out of Syria continues to have repercussions across the region. And outgoing Secretary of Defense James Mattis is asked to leave early as President Trump named a relative policy newcomer to replace him. A child died in the custody of U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, the second such incident this month, prompting an internal review of the agency's policies, and a tsunami in Indonesia left hundreds dead as the government struggled to help those affected and explain why there was no warning. So, as usual, a lot to talk about. Tracy, I'll start with you with this U.S. government shutdown. The stalemate has extended through the holidays, and I do not currently see a path for a resolution of this. What's interesting to me is, though, that we had a deal, and then we didn't have a deal. What happened to the deal that we had to keep the government open?
Well, the reports are that President Trump had agreed with the Democrats to pass a bill that would fund the government. Overnight, he saw criticism from some of the right-wing media, and he the next day caved and reversed himself. And so it's kind of, I think, disturbing to some people that that is what is influencing his thinking. But you're right, there was a deal, and then there wasn't a deal.
And we had a resolution that went that passed the Senate.
Yes.
100-0, I
yes.
believe,
uh-huh.
for fund, continuing to
right.
fund the government.
Right. Both sides agree there should be funding for border security. It's kind of a fake issue the way that Trump portrays it. He wants $5 billion for a wall that polls show most Americans oppose, experts say is not necessary, wouldn't be efficient anyway, and yet he has dug his heels in on that $5 billion for a wall. And I agree with you. I don't see a way out of this anytime soon. The last two shutdowns were resolved fairly quickly, but this one, between the holidays coming in and this sort of intransigent positions on both sides, it's hard to see how it's going to come to resolve.
And Philippe, why is this wall, why is this issue important enough for President Trump to want to have this shutdown of the government? Are we talking about money? Are we talking about the use of the money or a combination of the two?
Well, I think we're talking about politics, mainly. Mm. It's all about politics. It's not about money.
Not policy here.
$5 billion is nothing. It's 0.1% of the federal budget. There is a wall existing on over 728 miles of the border where it is practical to have some sort of barrier. And there are many areas where it doesn't make sense and where you even can't, because it's private property and it would take years to build anything there on the part of the federal government. So it sets the stage for the relationship that we will see between the Democrats having the majority in the House starting in January and this president. And as you said, there was a deal, there was the possibility that the White House would find a common ground with this new majority in the Congress and try to work with them. Donald Trump was accused by some people representing his base to cave in, to be strong enough. And that's when he had to choose between finding a way to work with your opposition, your political opposition, or flatter your base and basically continue what he's been doing for the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's worrying because he will have to work with the Democrats one way or the other during the next 2 years. For instance, in 2019, the Congress will have to raise the debt ceiling, and that will require some sort of agreement with the Democrats.
Brings me to my next point, Tracy. What happened to the art of the deal? What happened to persuasion in politics? It seems that everyone takes these extreme positions where I get what I want, or I shut it down, or I cut it off, or nothing moves forward. Is there an opportunity here to deal when we talk about a deal that was placed on the table for $1.6 billion for border security? Because both sides agree that border security is an important issue. Can we get to some sort of practical resolution? And who would negotiate something like that?
Well, I agree with Philippe. This is all about politics. It's really not about dollars and cents. And for years, sort of the bipartisanship in Washington has disappeared, and it's gotten worse now with this administration that does take such extreme positions that aren't even mainstream Republican positions. I think the one thing that would make a difference is public pressure. And right now, Americans are a little distracted by aren't really focusing on the shutdown because of the holidays, end of year. But I think at some point, as this continues, there are 800,000 people who aren't receiving their paychecks.
You know, it's interesting. I've heard people talk about this as a small sliver of the government. It's about 25% of the government that's got that.
It's not all of it. It's a lot of people. And increasingly, ordinary Americans are going to feel the effects of this. And I think that pressure, if that grows, that will be the one thing that will force the sides to make some sort of compromise, if that's even possible.
During the campaign, Philippe, the refrain from the Trump campaign at that time, and the Trump administration, at least for a while, was Mexico will pay for this wall.
Right.
What is the likelihood that Mexico will pay for this wall? And if they did, what form would that take?
Well, the president is still pretending that in some way Mexico will be paying for the wall, because the new trade agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico, the USMCA, is supposed to have the U.S. spare so much money that the wall would pay for itself. This doesn't make sense. I mean, it's like adding apples to bananas. I mean, it makes no sense in economic terms. And as much as this issue and this shutdown is about politics, the solution will be about finding a face-saving outcome for both sides. And also, since it will, I think, preview the relationship for the next 2 years, what is the interest of the Democrats right now to show any weakness to this president? And what is the interest of this president of caving in to the Democrats? So the spark that started this thing is very, very small, but the solution will be very difficult.
Yeah, I say difficult, not complicated, but certainly difficult. I would agree with you there. Very quickly, just give me prediction. I never like shy away from a good prediction. Tracy, where do you predict this shutdown will end?
Oh, let's see. Maybe the end of January.
End of January 2019.
Yes. 2019. Next year.
Oh, yeah. I just want to make sure we had that specified.
Not 2 years.
And Philippe, what
well, that would be already something huge.
That would be
maybe
a
I'm optimistic.
Yeah,
but
that would be no. Well, frankly, that would be 5 weeks. That would be terrible.
Yeah,
because then you will start to see the economic cost of all of this.
Yeah,
and so far the estimates that I've seen go from $300 million per week to $1.2 billion. So, the longer it lasts, the bigger the damage.
You want to give me a prediction?
Let's say mid-January.
Mid-January.
I'm a reasonable guy.
Yes, you are. We need you in the room. Let's turn to U.S. markets. And U.S. markets are experiencing historic levels of volatility. The Dow Jones Industrial, a bellwether economic indicator, has either gained or lost more than 250 points in 8 of the past 9 trading sessions. That used to be what was known as a large change when we talk about 250 points. Now it's sort of, wow, you know, it's happening all the time. Record losses followed by the single largest gain in one day in history. To go to you again, Tracy, what do you see as some of the main drivers of the uncertainty and volatility in these markets?
Well, Philippe was just mentioning the economic costs of the shutdown, and I think the shutdown has an impact on the markets, perhaps indirectly, but as investors see this uncertainty in the government, President Trump's sort of wavering back and forth, his threats to the Fed chairman for raising rates, interest rates, all of these things have a political impact and do contribute to the ups and downs. I think people also are seeing the global economy start to slow down, and so that is having an impact as well.
Plus the trade wars with China.
Europe,
and so it all adds up. And the president, in unpredictability, I think it's beginning to play on the nerves of the investors. They realize that maybe his economic policy, they like it. They like tax cuts. They like a lot of things, but they don't like a lot of the craziness that's coming out of the White House, even on topics that have nothing to do with the economy. But at some point, when you see a president who is, you know, acting on his whims, be it on Syria or whatever the topic, it gets on your nerves, I think, and that's what we see.
But to be fair, let's point to a 50-year low in unemployment. We have 3.4% GDP growth in the third quarter, which is pretty close to the 4% that everyone said was a pipe dream.
Yeah.
Okay, it was totally unreachable.
Some could argue that it's just a correction, that overall the three indexes have gone down 9% in December, with all the ups and downs that we've seen. So there is nervousness, there is some volatility, but the economy is still in good shape. So yes, you're right. Maybe it's just a correction and the market will start on a safer ground in January.
We got about a minute, Tracy. The new Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has raised interest rates several times during his tenure, which has not made the president happy. Do you think that he is looking to make a change there, and would he be allowed to make that sort of change?
President Trump?
Yes.
I don't know the legal points there. It would be unusual for a president to fire the same Federal Reserve chairman that he just appointed. So I think the optics, as they say here, would be very bad. And he's raising rates after a long period of no raise in interest rates. And so I think that it's to be expected, frankly, that I think it's pretty sound policy, but Trump doesn't like
it.
The
law is not clear, but I think you're right. What the president wants is a scapegoat, not a new Fed chairman.
We're going to have to take a break right there. We'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Philippe Gelly, Washington correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome back. In news that really has global implications, we say that a lot of things, but certainly this falls into that category squarely. President Trump decided to pull U.S. troops out of Syria in more or less immediate fashion. In a response, former Secretary of Defense James Mattis submitted his resignation, pointing to that, among other policy decisions by the Trump administration, as reasons for his departure. And he was meant to have another 2 months in office as a transition period. And that was cut short, and a relative newcomer was named as the acting Secretary of Defense. Let's start at the top, because this is a very rich topic. We want to get to as much of this as we can. We'll start with you, Philippe. What was the Trump administration rationale?
Well, apparently, if we hear what the president has said during his trip to Iraq in the past week, his generals requested several times that he extend the mission in Syria for another 6 months, at least two or three times. And he told them that was not the reason we were, the United States were in Syria was only to defeat ISIS, the Islamic State, that it was almost done, and that they wouldn't get this a new 6 months extension. For someone like Jerome Mattis, the former defense secretary, it was like, you know, abandoning partners, allies, especially the Kurds, on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a reason good enough to resign, in his view. Also for the U.S. Special Envoy to the coalition in Syria, Brett McGurk, who also resigned.
Yes.
So there is a lot of disagreement in the administration, and it was reported that, first of all the advisors of national security surrounding the president disagreed with his decision to pull out right now and in this fashion. Secondly, that he did not even read the resignation letter from Secretary Mattis, and that he was upset by the press coverage, the media coverage of his resignation. And that's the reason why he requested that he leaves by January 1st instead of the end of February.
Instead of giving that transition period. Tracy, the question I like to ask, to throw a little Latin out there, one of the few phrases I know is qui bono, who benefits from this? As you go down the list, and there's parties like ISIS, Iran, Russia, Saudi Arabia, who really benefits from this?
Well, you're naming them, Russia, Iran, Turkey, and Bashar Assad, the president of Syria. What's so curious about all of this, and I think a lot of Americans are ready to get out of Syria. The point is it must be done in a more orderly fashion. At least that's the opinion of the national security advisors. But the two consistent goals of President Trump's very inconsistent foreign policy have been challenging Iran and supporting Israel. And this is going to help Iran and hurt Israel. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. The beneficiaries are not who this administration would normally want to benefit, presumably.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he's really handing, you know, Iran will now have a pathway to the Mediterranean, essentially, through Syria. And Russia has long wanted to establish its sort of beachhead in the Middle East, and Syria is going to be it. And Turkey may be allowed to go in and mow down the Kurds, as far as we know. So And then
you have the Kurds, who are completely flummoxed by
totally.
By
they feel so betrayed. They were trained by the American Special Forces and were the fighters, our proxy army in this battle, and they're being abandoned. And then President Assad, you see now he's starting to come in out of the cold. Earlier this week, the United Arab Emirates was the first Arab country to reopen its embassy in Damascus after all of them had closed the embassy in protest over the government of Assad and the war. And now the UAE is going back in, and I think we're going to see other countries go back in. And it is tacit recognition that Assad has won the civil war.
Philippe, you have Secretary Mattis asked to leave. You have Patrick Shanahan coming in. Who's Patrick Shanahan?
Well, he's a former Boeing executive. Apparently, he's an engineer by training. He's from the MIT. He is apparently a very talented guy in terms of... Donald Trump has said he's a good buyer.
Excellent.
Yeah. And
a lot of purchases being done at the Defense Department.
And although he's only acting secretary so far, he might stay quite for some time. The thing is, He's been focused on managing the Department of Defense so far when Secretary Mattis was dealing with the strategic issues with Iran, with the wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, facing the challenges of Russia and China or North Korea. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Shanahan so far hasn't had to deal with that. And we don't know anything about his knowledge, his capability to deal with that. And he has a reputation of being a sort of a yes man in the Pentagon, in the sense that, for instance, when the president decided to create this space army, this new space
the
army.
Space Force.
Space Force, yeah. Right? Almost everybody in the Pentagon said that that would be another layer of bureaucracy and for no much gain in terms of efficiency, because the Air Force was already covering the airspace, if you want. But one guy said, no, this is the president's vision and we're going to make it happen.
And that was?
And that was Patrick Shanahan.
So it's a reliable supporter for
it seems so.
President Trump and the Pentagon. As we close out this subject, Tracy, one thought is that I put myself in the shoes of Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and White House advisor who has been given responsibility for brokering a Middle East peace effort. And when he heard President Trump saying that the U.S. would stop being, quote unquote, suckers in the Middle East and the U.S. would, quote, not be the policeman of the world, unquote, put yourself in Jared Kushner's shoes. When you hear those words as a person supposed to broker Middle East peace, does pulling out of the U.S. at this time help or hurt that effort?
I think it hurts an effort that is already very hurt. I think so far the kind of peace agreement that Jared Kushner has been pushing has been very unpopular with all of the Arab states. From my reporting indicates it's very supportive of Israel. Israel's demands and the Palestinians are fairly well dismissed. Is that being the policeman of the world? No, because you're taking a side, and that's really not being a broker, you know, neutral broker. So I think the whole process is already perhaps doomed, and this doesn't help.
Right. Another thought that I had was I still think back often to the 2-hour meeting that President Trump had alone in a room with Vladimir Putin. And I wonder if this scenario came up. Of course, none of us will ever know because none of us was in the room. I want to change the subject that does cause much concern personally for me, I might say. Felipe Alonso Gomez, 8 years old, died in the custody of U.S. Border Control officials. The child was detained with his father on December 18th after illegally crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. The second child to die in U.S. Border Control custody this month, a 7-year-old girl, Jacqueline Kale, also from Guatemala, developed a high fever and died earlier this month. To start with you, Philippe, is this the new normal? Is this what we're going to expect from...
Well, 2 children dying at the border, that hadn't happened in the last decade. So it's certainly not the new normal, but it's new. And it's a new set of events that the government has to deal with. There are several facts. First of all, it's clear that there are a growing number of families coming to the borders. And it's pretty well admitted, even by those coming, that they think they have a better chance to get through if they come with a child. And of course, the journey is very, very extremely difficult, especially for children.
Yeah.
There were 25,000 families arrested at the border last month. Yeah, it's about 2,100 people a day in the centers, in the facilities of the border patrol right now. There are more diseases than ever. I mean, the DHH's secretary, Mrs. Nielsen, has requested the help of the medical service of the Coast Guard, the Center for the Control of Disease. And so there are worries that there might be even some sort of contagion, some virus being transmitted. The facilities themselves that the U.S. puts these people in are 30, 40 years old. They are designed for male immigrants able to travel by themselves, not for families or for children. They are nicknamed ice boxes because it is so cold there.
Right.
But we cannot blame directly. The fact that those 2 children died in custody doesn't make it proof that they died because of the way they were treated. It's not something that you can point as a fact at this stage.
Good point. Secretary of Homeland Security Nielsen has started investigations, Tracy, into the circumstances that involved this. Could you compare her response to what happened? And does it match the feeling of the American people?
Well, I think the public was really alarmed about this. I think in their minds, it underscored what many see as a cruel policy of separating children from their parents, which was happening a lot the last few months. And the treatment, the conditions in which these families are, as Philippe said, in facilities that are not prepared for these types of people, understaffed, ill-equipped, and et cetera. Mm-hmm. It is true that families are being told, take a kid and you'll get in. That's been happening since 2014-15 when I was covering a similar migration of unaccompanied minors and minors. So it is true that happens. I mean, the bottom line here is that more has to be done, and I hate to sound cliched, but the root causes of these migrations, the poverty, the violence, which the U.S. has had a big role in historically. So I think that's where you really need to focus resources, though that is also a long-term process.
Yeah, there's a retail saying that goes, you broke it, you bought it. And I think that there's a lot of brokenness that's in Central America that needs to be held accountable. Before we close, I just want to mention the volcano eruption that caused a tsunami or wall of water in Indonesia that killed over 400 people, displaced tens of thousands more. Terrifying event came without warning. There is some consternation over the fact that the warning systems of the federal government of Indonesia, that those systems were not working, which is why the warning wasn't there. But most of all, it's a humanitarian issue. So our hearts and our thoughts are certainly with the people in that country, and we wish them all the best as they recover from this event. That is all the time we have for this week, though. We want to thank Philip Gilly, Washington correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor. Thanks for listening.